Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Worldwide Knicks podcast. A little bit of a different detour from what we're normally doing. A special guest with us is just me, just Omar today. I'm super happy to introduce my special guest here from, I can't really even introduce this guy properly, you know, so many accolades, but from Knicks Film School and Final Review is Andrew Claudio. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Omar. It's a pleasure to be here. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise, man. And it's funny, you know, we always talk to a bunch of people in around Knicks Twitter, but I was always saying I really wanted to talk to Andrew because he's really the nuts and bolts that pushes one of the biggest content houses for Knicks Twitter around there, right? For Knicks content. You know, I kind of put you guys and Knicks Fan TV as kind of like the gold standard.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, for sure. So I just want to just jump right in, man. I always like to ask guests, you know, how'd you start following the team? And for you, how'd you start to decide to want to create content about the team?
Ooh, wow. So how did I start? Like, when was I first a Knicks fan? So I don't know if this is common for, I know it's common for John and it's common for me too, but our first introduction to basketball was Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. So like Michael Jordan, I don't know if people know this. John mentioned it on a pod over a month ago, but like his first favorite basketball player was Michael Jordan. Same for me, the first introduction I have of basketball is Michael Jordan. And when he was leaving for the second time, I decided to check out the local team. And that 99 Knicks season was my first indoctrination into Knicks basketball. And it's been amazing since, and nothing but successful runs to the playoffs here and there. But that was, I guess, that 99 team holds a special place in my heart. John Macri, for those who don't know, John talks about Sprewell being his favorite Nick. Allen Houston would be mine. Those are the original guys that talk about bucket lists for the KFS podcast. Right. Those would be the guys that mean the most as far as Knicks fans are me being a Knicks fan is concerned. And then as far as content goes, so I went to school. I graduated from Liberty University in Virginia. I got a degree in digital media for most of that degree, it was broadcast journalism. And around my senior year, I decided to focus more to the digital side. And I was looking for work. And rather than, you know, go the traditional route of like started as a production assistant, work your way up, I saw the create a job way being much more, I want to say simple, because it definitely is not. I'm sure you can understand right. that. But carving your own way just seemed more of a path I'd rather pursue. And we're very blessed and very lucky that the past couple of years have led to a little bit of success. And we're very appreciative and we're looking to keep going. But that's as far as content creation is concerned. It really, like I've hosted a Mets show before, as you mentioned. I host a movie podcast as well. My old gig was just an entire podcast network that I tried to put together. And then when I left there, I reached out to John. I was like, I have nothing to do right now. And I'm kind of at a crossroads. Do you need a producer? And he was like, I mean, I don't have one. So if you'd like, and then I'm like 2 months later, the pandemic happened and the Knicks went away. So it was like, it was funny that actually as terrible as like those 9 months were for the world, we really built a bond and had to get creative. And he, you know, learned to trust some of my ideas. I learned what he's like very good at, and we've developed a nice little chemistry. And, you know, to make a very long answer, just a little shorter, the rest is kind of history after that, getting involved with Knicks Film School and then, you know, creating what we've been lucky enough to create today.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny you're talking about that 99 team initially is, that's probably when I also fell in love with the team. So, you know, I grew up in Queens and you know, I was born in
Where in Queens?
I was in Astoria. So,
okay. I'm in Bayside right now.
Oh, no way. No, yeah. I got a bunch of family who live there. So, I didn't really, you know, my dad wasn't super into any sports really, but he loved Jordan, like you mentioned. And, you know, I got into the league like in the mid 90s. So I was like 8 years old. And I remember my first Knicks experience being, you know, the OJ game, you know, when, you know, they're flicking between. And but when I really got into it was that 99 team. And I think my whole family loved Allen Houston. So I'm with you on that. I love Spree, but, you know, Houston was my guy as well.
Yeah.
So, but it's funny, you mentioned that you, you know, you went to school for media. So I guess that kind of dovetails into my next question, which is, you know, Knicks Twitter kind of went a little crazy, as they always do, right?
I don't know what you're talking about.
never go crazy. Super
Knicks Twitter,
super balanced conversation.
Yeah.
But they kind of, you know, were going crazy about the national media getting mad about at Jalen Brunson's introduction, not having any media presence there. The beat writers got mad. And so I guess, like, what's your, like, takeaway from that as somebody who studied media and they're kind of in the media? John has had credentials, obviously, at post-game conferences. So what's your read on them not allowing media into that introductory conference?
So I want to preface with the fact that I speak for me and not anybody else, whether it be at Knicks Film School or Blue Wire, any reflection of anybody else. This is, as you mentioned, my take. Mm-hmm. On the matter. And I recognize and do share the opinion that this franchise is covered differently. The tabloid nature in which some of the sensationalized content gets put out there, I think is worth calling out and is worth, you know, recognizing for what it is. There is very little journalism out there on First Take. There is few and far apart a productive conversation about the Knicks because they're applying what the Knicks have been for the last 20 some odd years, give or take, you know, a Carmelo Anthony year here and there. They're applying that to an entire situation. And I think to kind of psychoanalyze it a bit, there is a portion of the fan base that's like, well, what does it have to do with Leon Rose? Like, what does that have to do with right now? Why are you applying the sins of Steve Mills or the sins of Isaiah Thomas to this regime? Having said that, I don't think it's defensible to not have media there. I just don't. I personally was offended by the fact that they introduced Jalen Brunson without fielding questions. I don't agree with the decision to hold to shut the media out. Recognize there are people in the beat that we like, Fred Katz, Ian Bagley, moments of Mark Berman, and they weren't allowed there either. And this isn't like us cozying up to them because they come on our show. They have a responsibility and they do their job well. We all love Chris Herring. It's why we made his book a number one bestseller. Right. And I echo his sentiments. I don't know if you watched the TV show The Boys on Amazon.
No, I have not.
Okay, so I won't spoil anything, but there's a character on there called Homelander. And he exhibits behavior as a bit of an allegory for the former president of the United States as of 2 years ago and potentially the future president of the United States. We'll see what happens. The point being, the combative nature he used to have with the media was disgraceful. And this is along the same lines where you can pick and choose the coverage that you want. There's a reason that there is a cable news network that is dedicated to reporting misinformation about what happened on January 6th, and nobody can hold them accountable because people can choose the facts that they want. And look, this is sports. It doesn't matter. Right. Who cares if people got to ask Jalen Brunson questions about tampering or questions about Donovan Mitchell? Like, at the end of the day, like, who cares? But there are some reporters that are really good at their jobs that may decide, all right, let's start asking some stuff that actually matters. Let's ask about Rick Brunson, if any investigations were done into the reason why he no longer is at the job he used to have before this one with the Timberwolves. It's bad PR on the Knicks stand, on the Knicks side of things, but it's also just, as somebody who appreciates good journalism, has a background in not muckraking, but finding truth. And like, we call it out when it happens. Like, I've called out a Berman article before. I've called out a Bondi article before. I don't like the sensationalized way that Stephen A. Smith rants about the Knicks because he knows it will go viral. But like, to bring it back to that Homelander point, there's a point in the show, The Boys, where he starts to realize, there's a meme that's gone around Twitter lately where he does something
Oh, with a smile and all that.
Right. And it's an awful thing that he does in the show. I won't spoil it. But then the crowd applauds him and he has this realization like, oh, I don't have to do the right thing. And I will be applauded for it. And it's a slippery slope that I think this fan base is applauding. Absolutely call out ESPN for the bullshit. My bad. Can I curse on here?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. Call ESPN out for the stuff they do. I don't watch First Take. I have a job. I don't like, no, this is no offense to people that watch First Take, obviously, but like there are better places to find analysis of like the reason I love Christopher Mad Dog Russo is it's very clear. He's in on the bit. He's there to say the stupidest thing possible, and I will be entertained by it every time. To take that for like journalism is not real. There are journalists that cover the Knicks currently, and you got me going because I've largely stayed out of it. Personally, I can't defend it. You cannot just decide who gets to cover your team and when they get to cover it. You have a responsibility to the public to answer questions if questions need to be asked. And, you know, I'm sure that is a minority opinion among this fan base. And I at a certain point, don't care. This is a principle I believe in and saw it attacked for an entire administration. And it's what I'm hoping doesn't trickle its way down into other portions of society that I actually pay attention to. So there. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
There it is. When I first saw news, I'm like, oh, who cares? Whatever, you know, you're introducing a free agent. But then I kind of thought about it from your lens, you know, outside of this podcast, I'm like aspiring journalist on the tech side myself. So I thought like, all right, if I, in the distant future, was able to interview an Elon Musk or something like that, theoretically speaking, and he kind of cuts me out of a Tesla press event, then I'd be pissed, right? Mm-hmm. And so I understand how you feel, how a Berman, a Bondi, I subscribe to The Athletic for Fred Katz, you know? So I want to see him be able to ask Jalen Brunson a question or Isaiah Hartenstein, whoever they're introducing a question. And so, yeah, I'm kind of like, I don't really agree with, to your point, just this hard stance a lot of fans took, like, well, who cares, you know? And ESPN's in their feelings and, you know, opinions on ESPN aside, you know, it's, you know, you've got to let journalists do journalist things, you know, and that's kind of the way I look at it.
Isaiah Thomas might still be the president of the Knicks if journalists didn't do good jobs the mid 2000s. So if you go to war with the media, it's just a battle you don't normally win. And just from like a PR perspective, it's also stupid. There's a reason why Mark Cuban and the Mavericks have had so many things happen that have been reported and alleged against their entire organization internally, and they seem to go away. And I don't like that. I think there should be more responsibility over there, but like Cuban understands PR. Cuban understands like how to make something go away, which the cynical side of me is like, that shouldn't happen. Like, he's a billionaire. We should hold him just as accountable as we do with James Dolan. One is really good at PR. The other is arguably the worst. So.
Yeah. It's funny bringing up Dolan. I just feel like I find myself halfway defending him a lot of the time. Just like, it's like, you know, the guy is, his job is to make MSG money, and he does that very well. So, but I kind of wanted to jump into Knicks Film School specifically. So one thing that I always kind of noticed, you know, I've been kind of subscribing to guys since the Julius Randle MIP season, I guess, you know, that magical time, you know,
the sunshine and rainbows of Julius Randle making every jump shot.
Yes. I tell you what, man, that season was great for me because on a personal front, I was in a bad place and that teammate made things fun, you know, so I'm never going to regret that season because I look at it differently. But kind of brought me to think about, you guys have like two primary sources of content or methods of content. You have the post game reaction pods, right? And you have like the plan pods, you know, where John and Jeremy will kind of go back and forth, or you have a guest on. And I find there's like such a difference in tone, right? Because like the post game is so reactionary, getting the super chats going and all that. And then the plan pods like this, it's like cap or no cap, super structured the conversation. And, or, you know, you're talking about like, even when you talk about the same player from the same week, I'll use Julius Randle as an example. Like, you could be doing a post game and John would be like losing his shit and the super chat's going crazy. How could he go 3 for 15 or whatever? And then There's a little bit more nuanced conversation on the regular pod where he's just kind of like, well, if he did this, maybe it would be a little bit better. And so I guess, like, how do you navigate those two different tones for like Nick's film school as a whole?
I mean, I gotta be honest, the dirty little secret of the difference in tone is that, like, they're two different things. The planned pods happen on off days most of the time, so there's nothing really to react to except the latest news that we have to plan for. The post-game pods are just that. They're a reaction to what we just saw. John is really good at reacting. We have a couple of guys that are really good at processing the information as it comes in from a game. I not to toot my own horn, but I find that I'm decent at recognizing the importance of certain things and, like, context. You know, when they beat the Miami Heat, I was lucky enough to the quickly comeback fourth quarter. I was lucky enough to do the post game that night. And, like, I thought that was, like, a real statement made by this second unit that, like, you've been underplaying us, Tibbs. And now that your hand is forced, you know, you kind of have to recognize that we deserve more playing time. And it's why I think you heard from source Mark Berman that Tibbs somewhat regrets the amount of playing time that he didn't give to OB and IQ during the season. So yeah, like, things like that are things we try to do with the post game where it's reactionary. We've started to experiment with a panel a bit, but the planned nature, like, we have Google Docs and calendars set up to plan out, like, weeks in advance. It's kind of an OCD of mine that I can't go into a week knowing, like, not knowing who we're going to have on the show. I think it's been to our betterment that, like, I have the next two guests, so the next three guests planned on our schedule, along with for John, as well as, like, our Sunday pod with Jeremy. And yeah, it's just, it really is just like a regular podcast that you're listening to that is different than the pod you get from the pod that you get from a post game, you know, like, where we're all emotional and in it. And then the regular pod, if you want to call it that, is we've had time to process everything. Now here's the next day take of it all, you know?
Yeah, I kind of look at it's almost like a reflection of being a human, right?
You're like, yeah, a little bit.
You react instantly to things that happen, and then you process information, like you said. And then you're like, all right, well, this is what it really means. This now, yeah. I can move on with my life. And so, by the way, congratulations on your YouTube subscriber number. I think you guys just recently hit 10,000.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, I know you were kind of like instrumental in making that happen. But another platform you've jumped into recently is Patreon. For me, again, who writes about tech, is a very interesting topic to cover. The rhetoric aside, a platform like Patreon and OnlyFans are kind of a different type of model, you know, that direct to creator model. You know, you guys, obviously, you do your town halls on there for the higher tiers, and you do a lot of general MBA content on there. So I guess what kind of went into the decision to say, okay, we want to add a different revenue stream in Patreon versus the ad-supported podcast and YouTube?
As far as the decision goes, I mean, when I say I was literally on vacation and thinking, like, on vacation, I reflect a bit and I just kind of like, I delete Twitter. I go away. Smart. And yeah. And I just texted John, like, cause we both, obviously we have the Zach Lowe drinking game. I'm an avid listener of Simmons and Russillo. Yep. And a lot of the Ringer pods. And, like, we both have NBA takes. And ironically, what we've found amongst Knicks fans is, like, if we get into a 15-minute conversation about the Durant trade, that, like, if we're doing it live, people start to tune out. And we thought, like, hey, if people are interested, we'd be having this conversation anyway. I think that more than anything was, like, we would in text have a back and forth of, like, did you hear, like, the rankings that Simmons did with Russillo? This is ridiculous. And we'd go back and forth with, well, what would yours be? And before I realized, I just thought on, I was on vacation in Clearwater last year, and I just was like, maybe there's another form of content. And if the revenue's there, like the work is worth it too, you know? And look, I hate to sound like I'm putting, like, not taking too much credit or like too humble about this, but like the support we've gotten on there is overwhelming. People paying to get extra content from us is something we had no idea whether it would be successful or not. We took the store that we have, which, I mean, we could do more with, but we honestly don't plan to a little bit. But we took that as a model that, like, okay, like if we're giving them extra content, maybe there's a thing here. And like, I've made some friends that are like I speak to, mostly Met stuff, but like I've you know, been able to develop relationships through Patreon, and like the town halls are great because we get some connection with people. So as far as like what went into Patreon, it was literally just an extended arm that has nothing to do with the Knicks. If you're interested, come talk about the NBA with us. And it's like we do Ask Patreon polls that we started doing on our Patreon too. We do the drafts that we do once a month. We plan to do a lot of drafts this summer. We'll see if Donovan Mitchell lets us. But yeah, Patreon was really just like, I gotta be honest, there wasn't a lot of, you know, revenue source inspired ideas there. It was really just an extra place to create content, and then whatever revenue comes from it, you know, we'll enjoy it. And the patrons have just been unbelievable with their support in that.
Yeah, I kind of look at it as Knicks fans, I view them as intelligent basketball fans for the most part. You know, obviously you got some crazies or whatever, but you know, it that's every fan base in every sport. And now, you know, I relocated to the Detroit area, and you know, so a lot of Pistons fans around here, and like they're fans of the team, but I feel like the knowledge of the game isn't the same as a lot of the Knicks fans that I've encountered. You know, they just love the game so much. The game's so ingrained in the city, you know, there's parks everywhere, people always, you know, hooping or whatever. And I find that that's kind of why that translates. You know, a lot of your fans appreciate you breaking down something about Giannis, for example. You know, yeah. So that's a great space to do that in. You mentioned the Mets. So me growing up in Queens, I grew up a Mets fan. You know, right now they have that Derek Jeter documentary. So I'm curious, like, just a side question, what's your take on watching that, for one, and how, like, what's your take on Jeter as a whole?
Well, for starters, I mean, goddamn, this thing's not like coming out all at once. They're doing two episodes a week for 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Who cares? It's Derek Jeter, not Michael Jordan. I understand that, like, he was repped by Jordan Brand, but like Derek Jeter gets 4 weeks of content. I'm sorry. So Let me be clear. Derek Jeter is a deserved first ballot Hall of Famer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I hesitate to call him the greatest shortstop I've ever seen, because there are so many better defensive shortstops that exist. Literally just look at any metric, you know, gold gloves. We didn't know how to measure fielding percentage in a way that was analytically intelligent, which is why he has like three gold gloves or however many. But the point being, like, his resume is indisputable. And yes, like I know people go to the, if he did it in Kansas City, would he matter? Well, he did it in New York, which actually makes it better. Like, people we talked about what it's like to cover the team when it comes to the Knicks and what the media landscape is like here. For him to be able to do that here with the Yankees is even more impressive. So like, any ill will I have toward him is solely because I was 12 for the 2000 World Series where he ripped my heart out, and B, because there is an attitude amongst Yankee fans, Jeremy and I go back and forth with this sometimes, Oz and I go back with this sometimes, that because they chose the Yankees, they're better. And it's why I've enjoyed the last 13 years of them not winning a championship. And all that being said, I'm kind of the detractor on The Last Dance. I think it was good. I've rewatched it a couple of times, but let's not pretend this wasn't a product of executive producer Michael Jordan. Like, There are certain things, talk about journalism, there are certain things that demand a follow-up. So you're telling me that you called up a pizza place and said, hi, yeah, this is Michael Jordan, pizza place in Utah. Please send me a pizza to this hotel. Michael Jordan, please don't do anything. Like, there's no way that story doesn't demand a follow-up. But of course, yeah, it didn't, because executive producer Michael Jordan. And that's kind of the way a lot of these things have gone, you know, with like the Will Smith movie, Dear Richard, King Richard is similar in that executive producer Serena and Venus wanted to tell a version of their father's story that was from their perspective. Like, you guys called him crazy in the media. We want to show a different side of him, or at least how we saw him throughout our careers and why we appreciate what he did for us. And I'm curious if that's going to happen here. If, like, you're just not going to hear the name Mariano Rivera, the greatest closer of all time, and in my opinion, significantly more responsible for the Yankee success over that 20-year stretch than Derek Jeter was, but he was the face of it. And at the end of the day, you, pun intended, respect what he was able to do in a Yankee uniform. And I mean, I'm going to watch it. I got to be honest. I'm not like appointment watching it. I thought that this whole thing was dropping on Monday when after the home run derby. Right, and then when it didn't, I was like, I have to wait for this. Wait a minute. This whole thing should be available right now. What are you doing? You are not HBO Max. This is not Game of Thrones. You are not even Michael Jordan. This is not The Last Dance when there's nothing on for 5 weeks. But like, yeah, I'm gonna watch it. And if the footage is pretty cool, the getting to see when he was drafted,
that was nice. Yeah,
right. Like, that is what you get from these that you don't normally get from other. That's at least what I appreciated from The Last Dance, is like Michael Jordan hits the game winning shot against Utah, and that's where the story ends for us. And The Last Dance, like, let us see him get on the bus and celebrate. Let him, like, he's in his hotel room playing the piano, not knowing how to play the piano. And he's talking about the last shot when he's like, I everything was short. I had to hold on to that last shot. And it's like, okay, the access is what matters here. And I'm hoping we get some of that with whatever this Derek Jeter documentary is.
Yeah, it's you're really in it for those little 5 minutes of little extras. It's like, ooh, I would have never known that, you know, and that's a great part about it. But getting back on track here, so you know, try not to get off the rails too much, but you know, you guys have expanded, you know, your talent pool, I guess is the best way to put it, at KFS. You know, obviously it was you and John, and yeah, and then Jeremy, and you add in Chris Bursiainen and Ben Rinholtz. A lot of different personalities there, a lot of different opinions. And, you know, obviously Ben is more that film analysis. Chris did all this great stuff with Draft Class. And Jeremy's like your cap guy. So how you meld all those different personalities together, man, to, you know, it could be challenging, one could say.
So one quick correction. Jeremy was actually there before me.
Oh, my apologies. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I Jeremy and I actually did a Knicks podcast together at that old blog that I was working at. And John kind of came and scooped him up, and he was kind of doing half there, half here. I then realized that I didn't want to work at that blog anymore. And I, like, it was literally a Jeremy, you're free. Like, go to Knicks Film School. And then I asked Jeremy about production opportunities, and he was the one that actually connected me to John. So Jeremy deserves any credit for my involvement in Knicks Film School. As far as how we all play our roles well, there is a respect involved in all of us that, like, nobody thinks they're better than the other person. Like, obviously, like, tensions can get high in the heat of conversation and discourse sometimes, but like, John and Jeremy are in my wedding next year. The entire KFS crew is going to be at my wedding next year. These are people that, you know, I talk to every day, and as a result, I connect with every day. And yeah, I don't even know what he is to us now, Pat Riley. But he has the line about the disease of more, that once you've accomplished something of any level, there are parts of the team that then want more. The reason these championship teams never stay together as a whole is because, well, I've already accomplished this. Now I'm going to get more from me. And that really just like doesn't exist here. You know, I appreciate what John can do that I can't. He appreciates what I can do that he can't. We both feel the same way about Jeremy and Benji and Chris. And, you know, it's crazy to say it. It's one big happy family. We've talked to a couple people about expanding this summer, which, you know, should make the family even more fun and hopefully successful. But more than anything, it's just an understanding that we're all good at certain things. And as long as like we keep it respectful, that we never have to worry about somebody's head getting too big or somebody's ego getting too toxic, you know, so that way we were able to continue treading in the right direction together, you know?
Yeah, and that's such a fine line too, you know, between because especially when you're talking about kind of going at each other and disagreeing, mm-hmm. but not getting toxic, you know, and it's like, you know, the argumentative thing has been proven to generate interest with people for whatever reason, like people arguing with one another. Mm-hmm. Is why First Take and Undisputed have such high ratings as an example, you know. Yeah. There's just two guys yelling at each other all day, you know.
Yeah,
and but you know, being able to have that mutual respect after, it's such a, I feel like such a fine line to have to kind of cross.
It's one thing I'll say, because some people have, I read all the YouTube comments. I read all the mentions because I have
God bless you, man.
So John doesn't have to. But like I see all the discourse about when we were going back and forth with him about Tibbs, you know, during the season. And what people don't see is like the 10 minutes after when we've like stopped recording, when we reconnect and the dust settles and we've reestablish that like this is sports, you know, and that this is not personal. We have differing opinions and that has to be okay. There were moments throughout the season when it got a little repetitive and it toxic isn't the word, because I think certain things that are actually toxic deserve to be labeled as toxic. Yeah. But I think emotional really is the word, because like, yeah, Tibbs was doing the exact same thing over and over again. And it felt like we were being gaslit by like, of course you play Alec Burks 40 minutes and you play Emmanuel Quickly 7. And, you know, John's admitted that like it took me a while to see the fault in that. I still like, I kind of agree with him on to a point about like, well, what was he like, if this is his, like, what's the change that Johnny Bryant does, you know, like if he comes in. So Julius is still playing more than OB. He like maybe Quickly starts, but most likely he's still coming off the bench. Like what changes significantly? I still thought that, I mean, you look at the defensive numbers in the second half of the year, Tibbs can still coach, and, you know, we'll see what team he actually does coach this year, whether it has Donovan Mitchell or doesn't. It might be his greatest test about how to get people to play defense. But yeah, as far as that portion of the season right before the All-Star break, it did get heated at a certain point. I'll be very transparent about it. The All-Star break coming when it did probably helped a lot. But you know, we all kind of said like, we also recognized like this is a stem from the Knicks being frustrating. Like, I'm not actually frustrated with John. I'm frustrated that this is the product that we have to so intently cover. And I think it's why we like hit a mode come off season that like, great, that's done. Now let's get into the off season and cover it so intensely and so comprehensively the way that we have.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I applaud you guys, because like the creation of content when you're only covering the one team, you know, mm-hmm. it's, granted, a team that has a lot of interest with people, but, you know, just sometimes it's a struggle, you know, like, well, what are you going to talk about? Like with us, we took like multiple weeks off, man. We were just like, you know, we were just like, all right, well, let's come back around draft time and, you know, talk about some prospects, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, well, I'll turn the credit back over to our audience, because like, you better believe that we all were like, be obviously totally honest with you, this Donovan Mitchell trade needs to happen because we're all ready for a break at some point. But like, you know, they've made it, you know, something we look forward to, as well as something we're very ready, willing, and able to do, you know?
Yeah. So I kind of wanted to shift gears a little bit, talk a little bit about Final Review, which obviously your movie review podcast. And I have to thank you, actually, because I do listen to that podcast. And one of the like episodes I listened to was kind of a little favorite of mine, is when you guys talked about the House of Gucci movie. And
oh my gosh, that thing.
So literally that day I was gonna go to the theater and go watch it. I was like, oh, I don't know, I'm into historical shit, whatever, you know. And I was making myself some food. I was like, well, let me listen to a podcast while I make some food. So I put it on, and you guys are talking, you're ripping into it, and I was just like, man, maybe I shouldn't see this fucking movie.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't, and anybody I talked to was like, oh, I don't know, they had the same criticisms you guys had. So I guess my first question about it is, how did you decide you wanted to jump into making a podcast centered around film?
So that blog I used to work for, I did a movie podcast with them from 2016 to 2019.
Okay.
And when I came aboard Nick's Film School, I had also tried to do my own show. It was called Final Score. And like, I had like a guy I just talked baseball with, a guy I just talked football with, because there's like, as you can probably tell, I have multiple areas of interest. Like, there was a guy I just talked hockey with, and obviously basketball, but Oz was the person I brought on to talk about movies. And I noticed a rapport there. I had a, like, when he would come on, the episode was called Final Review. And listen, this was in the middle of the pandemic, but there was things being released straight to streaming, and we would react to like Christopher Nolan's Tenet, the movie on Hulu with Andy Samberg and the actress that plays the mother on How I Met Your Mother. Spoiler alert. But I noticed the chemistry there, and I pitched an idea to him that, like, Oz is very big into sabermetrics for baseball. He he watches sports through a lens of like data accumulation. I'm a little more emotional, where I react to the game, and he sees each game somewhat as a way to then recalculate the models and the probabilities, which like they're both very productive ways to evaluate sports. And we thought about like, how do you compare movies? Like, how do you compare, like, if say your favorite movie is The Godfather and my favorite movie is Jurassic Park, how in the world do you compare, like, what's good about The Godfather and what's good about Jurassic Park, you know? So we came up with the rating system and the final review of it all, 10 top five categories. Is it perfect? No. But ironically, we look back at season one that we did, and yeah, there was a pretty spot on sample of our rankings and where we would put. Like, I looked at my 1 through 25 based on my full scores of the 25 movies we did. And it's like, yeah, I would put this ahead of this. I would put this last. I would put this first. And ironically, it ended up working. So it was really just a different way, because like there are several movie podcasts out there, and the bonus reviews, I think, are great. And like, we've been back and forth about whether to get back into them, because there's been movies that have come out this summer. But yeah, it was really just a different way to talk about movies that wasn't the traditional, we just saw this, now let's talk about it. And the cool thing that I've found is that they'll, just like yourself, where like, you'll take our recommendation on something. I have so many people that come up to me and are like, this other movie that you mentioned, because you were talking about like The Dark Knight, and then there was this other Christian Bale movie, or this other Heath Ledger movie, or you were talking about The Social Network, and I went down an Andrew Garfield rabbit hole. Yeah, like Children of Men became like a darling to us, and come to find out, so many people hadn't seen it coming into that episode. But yeah, that more than anything was the reason why we decided to go that direction. And it's a full season of a show that I'm extremely proud of. Oz is a is one of my better friends that I talk to every day. And it's cool to be able to work with someone that you like talking to in that capacity.
That helps, you know.
Yeah, you know.
Well, you mentioned something about, you know, how things went to streaming in the pandemic. I guess you, as a guy who's like super into movies, I mean, how do you feel about this kind of a shift that a lot of these movies are taking, where some are going straight to streaming, some maybe go to the theaters for like a week or two, then go to HBO Max? I mean, do you think that's good or bad for movies in general?
It depends who you talk to. I gotta be honest. Yeah. Like, it's it's hit or miss with me. I think a movie like Top Gun Maverick needs to be in a theater. I think all these MCU movies need to be in a theater. But I also am somebody that gets frustrated when people pull their phones out in a movie theater. I don't go to movies with people that pull their phones out. That is a rule I have. My fiance, when we like first went to the movies, she pulled her phone out once and I was like, that's the end of that. And she never pulls her phone out since. I think there are smaller movies that, like, so I'm seeing Jordan Peele's movie Nope when we get done with this, when we get done talking. And like, I have no idea if the crowd's going to cooperate. And for a movie like that, that might actually do decent business because Jordan Peele has the cachet, I also have no idea, like, am I going to get stuck sitting next to somebody that's on their phone the entire time? Am I going to get stuck sitting next to a child that probably shouldn't be seeing a movie that late at night? And then I realized and got used to and appreciated the comfort of my own home with, like, I have a full 4K television with sound speakers. And look, I'm somebody that isn't technically married yet, have no kids. A trip to the movies for me is just that. Like, I can go to the movies by myself and be fine. The novelty of going to the movies is no longer being made to be a necessity, except for the event type movies and the hassle and inflation's a whole different conversation, but like the movie prices that exist now, like my dad and my mom, if they wanted to take me and my brother way back when to a movie, it was like $80 for tickets. And then, you know, God forbid we want to drink something at the movie. But before you know it, for a family of four, you're spending $100 at the movies for a movie you may or may not even like. So I miss the, like, I'm obviously going to have sentimental value to going to the theater. I'm not as like, movies are better in the theater, go see them, as some might be. There are some traditionalists. I do a podcast with one of them that believe all movies should be seen on the biggest screen possible. And I appreciate the take. I also recognize that times are changing and, you know, you either adapt, which I'm more comfortable doing, or you just keep going to the movies and you'll keep your small theater open. And hopefully you go enough times that, you know, it doesn't eventually turn into an AMC.
Yeah. Over here in my neighborhood, that happened recently to a little low Cineplex, and, you know, a local chain kind of that's kind of big in Michigan kind of took over that. And, you know, it's not the same. You know, it's there is, to me, that kind of a magic of the theater type thing. But to your point, you know, it's only thing people go see now, oh, that new Jurassic World came out, or there's that new Marvel movie or whatever. Mm-hmm. And which is unfortunate, but also I kind of look at it as the streaming platforms have opened up to exposure of a lot of like indie films and stuff like that, that, you know, maybe, you know, you might not have even thought of seeing in the theater before. So, you know, it's kind of a good and a bad, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I do want to ask about this when you kind of look at what you do at Final Review and what you do at Nick's Film School. Like, you know, that's obviously two very different topics, but I feel like the tones are a little bit different there, and that could be because of the people who are on those shows. But I mean, how do you differentiate between your approach to Nick's Film School versus Final Review?
Man, there's so much more research involved with Final Review. This is probably obvious, but like I'm recognized that I'm behind the scenes at Nick's Film School, and yeah, I'm the talent at Final Review. And, you know, John is I don't mean to keep name dropping him, although he's like one of my better friends, so I guess I can. He's really good at like, hey, like the interview we did today with Spencer Checkitz of ESPN in Utah, that was booked this morning, you know. And he's really good at like, hey, we've got an interview at one. Are you good? He's like, I will be. And he shows up, does a tremendous interview, and all I have to worry about are sound levels and framing and then timestamps afterwards. And he, for final review, I do not have that luxury of just showing up and, you know, kind of winging it coherently, at least. I'm also a bit of a perfectionist in the sense that, like, I can't, this is like my own personal thing, probably, I hate not knowing something. So I try to go in as informed, as prepared as possible to any pod appearance. I mean, for those of you that the crossover listeners that might listen to our Patreon pods, like, it's the same thing. I'll make sure I watch a game the night before, a game or two the night before, so I have something to bring to the table that's not just like, oh, I read the box scores and, you know, this is what I think of the Timberwolves. Like, no, I think Anthony Edwards is taking a leap. Like, I watched him play last night. There's something to that kid. So yeah, the approach is literally just one way I approach is meant for talent, and one way I approach is as intently and as dedicated and as far as quality goes, but the other is simply a behind the scenes role where I do my best to make John and Jeremy look as good as possible.
Yeah. So speaking about that, okay. I guess I want to pick your brain a little bit about like your process when you're editing your the podcast, when you're like clipping stuff, putting it on various social media stuff. Like, so for me, we finish our pod and I'm like the most tech savvy person, so I kind of got delegated with kind of doing all of that. And I just kind of, so, you know, it's a process learning different programs and things of that nature. So I remember you guys did some marathon live stream and you had posted something on Twitter about like drinking 3-4 cans of Red Bull. Cause you know, that stuff's exhausting, man. Mm-hmm. So I guess like, you know, what goes into you editing an episode of Nick's Film School?
I mean, I don't know if people see this, but like I take notes during every pod. Like this is okay. A page of notes that I take. That, I mean, cause I'm not on camera, people don't see, but
yeah.
So it depends really. For the regular pod with Jeremy, we have a set list of topics and a set list of segments, you know, with the detention and predictions and with the game ball, and then, you know, when I have one, a producer's corner. But I always know that like my Sunday nights into Monday mornings are taken, whereas the other pods are like a quick interview, and as while they might not need as much editing, I can take notes throughout the pod, and like I'll star something, usually be like, oh, this was good to clip, like I'll do that. And like, admittedly, we don't do it as much as I'd like to, but yeah, that is the, as far as the process is concerned, like it starts during the pod, you know, so to make my job as easy as possible. There are certain cuts that I'll make, but we're very rare because we're, again, very respectful. There is the rare moment where someone's internet connection isn't great. We used to record backup audio. I'd record on my side, they'd record on their sides individually, and it just turned into like, you're just wasting file space at a certain point. Mm-hmm. Zoom is dependable enough. But there are moments when like I'll recognize early on, all right, John's kids are screaming, Jeremy's got the air conditioning loud, let's switch to the backup audio. And from here on out, like that's the process for the rest of the pod. It's only been like 6 or 7 times that I've had to do that. And then as far as like what I used to edit, it's like I'm in a studio right now that I built in my fiance's apartment when I moved in, and like that was part of the deal that when I move, if I'm moving in, that I will need to build a studio. And I'm a devoted Adobe subscription person. I have no idea what the technical term would be, but I'm an advocate for the Adobe suite. So between Adobe Premiere, Adobe Audition, Photoshop, that's where all the graphics, all of the all the videos get edited, all the audio gets edited. Shout out to my education for that. So, that's the process. And then again, the OCD, every pod drops at midnight Eastern, every video drops as close to midnight Western as possible. And then if you're around the world, then it drops when it drops. But that's, it's something I learned this from Simmons, strangely enough. Bill Simmons once said, like, their pod routine, their pod schedule used to vary, but you want to train your audience when to expect a new episode, which is why, like, a consistent schedule matters. And I probably take it a little too seriously, like, so out of my comfort zone today to be like, so the Donovan Mitchell news might happen. Let's drop the Spencer Checkets episode now. But recognizing that we have to do it when in that order, because we may have a live stream to do tonight. But yeah, that's at least the process as far as that's concerned. And one that it's become like such second nature. Like it's close to breathing at this point, you know?
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a philosophy that we take as well. Like we always record on Sunday, look to upload on Monday. And it's funny, to your point about the international crowd, obviously my two co-hosts are, one lives in Scotland, the other in Portugal. So they're across the Atlantic. So I'll wake up to like a WhatsApp message that I received at like 3 a.m. Then they're like, oh yeah, KFS dropped a new episode. And Backreach talk about this. I was like, oh, okay. Well, now I know I'm going to listen to this morning, you know? So it's almost like I get a little preview of what's to come, you know, which is always nice. I couldn't have you on here today, especially, and not talk about Donovan Mitchell.
Andrew. Let's do it. Fellow Mets fan, Donovan Mitchell.
Yeah, I mean he's all in it, man. I respect it, you know, and better than being a Yankees fan, I guess. You know, it's just,
in my opinion, yes. In my humble opinion, yes.
So I've been kind of critical of the idea of bringing him here, and I know a lot of people have said, "Well, he's a star. You get the star. This team has assets. Get rid of those assets and get the star." Mm-hmm. Like my concerns of a small backcourt with Jalen Brunson, a perception that maybe he's not super committed defensively. You know, what's that going to look like? What does RJ Barrett look like in the system where he's probably the third, maybe fourth option, depending on what you view Julius Randle as? And so I guess, and the price just seems so high, you know, with all the draft picks and all the young assets. So I guess, where do you stand on one, bringing him, and two, the package to bring him in?
So this is where talking to Benji has convinced me a little more. Okay. Like there's a top 10 and not 10 offensive player in Donovan Mitchell. And like the defensive concerns are there, but like since the year 2001, we've seen the Knicks make the playoffs 5 times. Mm-hmm. Like, the problems with his defensive abilities and lack thereof will show themselves in the playoffs. You know, like I know that like the goal is to win a title, you got to become a perennial playoff team first. So that's my thought, is like the next step, because they're not going to tank. They're just not a franchise that's ever going to do that. At least not like on purpose, you know? So the next step in doing that is to go get a guy that's, you know, in the right system. And you look at what Utah was able to put together over the past couple of years, they had the right system. And it was like one of the better offensive teams in NBA history. And now his running mates are Jalen Brunson, who we like, and RJ Barrett, who we love. The Randle concern is real. And there's something to that Russell Westbrook report that I think is legitimate, that I don't think Randle's on this team if Donovan Mitchell is. So like, that's the other part. If you're interested in getting rid of Julius Randle or moving him someplace else, a Donovan Mitchell trade might lead to that. So we'll see. I'm sure you know this from the pod. I'm a very big Carmelo Anthony supporter. Yep. I would have made the trade that they made 10 times out of 10. I do think there needs to be a walk away price. I will say that you have to be able to go into this being okay not getting Donovan Mitchell. Because if like the price is just entirely too high, let somebody else go overpay for it, you know, because at the end of the day, it's real. Like he's not going to alone win you a title. he could be the first step toward making you a consistent playoff team, which will make the next guy that wants out that maybe used to have Leon Rose as his agent and is tired of James Harden want out. So, I mean, that's as far as like Mitchell is concerned. I'm always going to be in favor of like adding a better player to my basketball team or good basketball players to my basketball team. And again, this is where I'll plug Benji's thread that he did on Donovan Mitchell, where I guess he did it on Jalen Brunson, but the pod he did on Donovan Mitchell, where he talked about how this is one of the like better offensive players in the sport that we have. John's covered this extensively in the newsletter as well. And as long as like picks aside, like if it's three unprotected firsts, like 24, 26, and 28, you throw in two of the protected firsts and like the swaps shouldn't matter. You're going to be better than the Jazz if you're trying to win and they're not. So those are 2 years that Walt Perrin can work his magic. And then if you're giving up a lot of pick capital, you should be able to, because that's what Danny Ainge wants. He wants pick capital. I firmly believe in, like Spencer Cech has talked about it today, that like if you're drawing a line in the sand, like we are not giving you any of the young guys that we personally love in this fan base, that Danny Ainge is going to be like, so am I gonna let the fact that Quentin Grimes is not in the deal be the reason I don't get three Knicks unprotected picks? So yeah, that's where I stand. Like I'm very pro go add a really good basketball player to the Knicks while recognizing there has to be a walkaway point. And like you can't have, as much as I don't think the Melo trade was as detrimental as some people do, I will hear people out that like what they were able to work with afterwards was less than they would have been able to had he just gone in free agency. There's so many other counters I have for that, but like you have to be able to make the next trade after this, which is what I think Leon Rose is trying to do, which is why this deal hasn't been done yet, you know? So we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, the Melo trade happened when I was a much less informed basketball fan, you know? And, okay. And you know, at the time I was like, oh, you're getting rid of all these guys who, cause like that first half season of Amari as the guy mm-hmm. was fun. You know, that was an interesting team to watch, you know, just from a fan perspective. But when you really think about it, like Melo was brought over to form a dynamic duo with Amari, and Amari's knees were Amari's knees, you know, and
literally every possible thing seemed to go wrong. Amari's knees, the amnesty, Mont Shumpert tears his ACL, the back and forth with D'Antoni and Melo. And look, the 54 win season, a season the Knicks haven't had since the late 90s. Like I defend it as like, so the Knicks got Carmelo Anthony and 2 years later, they were the two seed. Like, tell me where the process was bad. The issue, like I have significantly more agita over the Bargnani trade than any Melo trade that the Knicks did. You know, they showed that they were not able to competently build around a future Hall of Famer, similar to how like Dallas forever didn't know how to put a championship team around Nowitzki. And then 1 year it clicked. I thought that was the formula. 1 year it could click if you put the right pieces around Melo, and they just didn't have the right guys to really didn't have the right guys to put those pieces around Melo. Which is why there's so much revisionist history about what he actually accomplished when he was there. The actual trade itself, I think, I also personally, and this is, I'm speaking for me, I was never like the Donnie Walsh save the Knicks person. I was like, so you cleared the runway for LeBron and Dwayne Wade, and like you wanted to put the super team together here. And if they don't make the Melo trade in a span of 7 months, all you've got to show for it is Amari Stoudemire and like an eight seed, you know, because they were 20-18 when they made the trade. So like you can't, like they traded a first round pick to offload Jared Jeffries and then didn't get LeBron. So what am I supposed to, say about that? The reason the Knicks didn't have a pick in 2012 is not because of the Melo trade. It's because Donnie Walsh cleared the runway to sign two stars and signed one with bad knees. So that is my rant on my defense.
Much appreciated.
My defense of the Carmelo Anthony saga, that it just at the end of the day, I think Denver was going to trade him anyway. And if you didn't want Melo, that's actually a defensible take. Like I think the Knicks should have waited for Chris Paul instead of Melo. Like, all right, you know what? That's fair. But you can't reasonably look at your fan base and be like, our plan is to build through the draft and like be young and exciting, when all you had been preaching for like 3 years since you got there was, we're gonna get two guys in the summer of 2010, and you got the fifth best player from that year, and like he's got shaky medicals. So yeah, all that to say, I stay Melo forever. And I do think they're two very different situations, the Melo and the Donovan Mitchell trade too.
Yeah, and you know, which is so funny how a lot of fans are saying, well, this is the Melo trade all over again. We're gutting our roster for, you know, this, you know, B plus star, you know, and I guess is the best way to characterize that opinion, right?
Do you remember how many picks the Knicks traded for Melo?
Not off the top of my head, no.
It's one pick and one swap. It's one pick and one swap. Imagine if like today being like, we can get Donovan Mitchell, but they're asking for one pick and one swap. Like that swap was never supposed to matter, but Phil Jackson had, at that point, had no idea how to build a team, you know? So that's where I go to, like, it was four players, it was three starters, and then Timofey Mozgov, a pick, and then a swap. And then there was like a bunch of other stuff that filled salary. The Knicks had to take on Chauncey Billups, but like the detrimental nature was, you could only be argued that you think Melo would have come in free agency, which Denver was going to trade him regardless. So then was the time to get him. And I don't know. I remember listening to podcasts and reading articles at the time that we didn't know if there was going to be a season the next year because the looming lockout, and the players union was telling all of its prospective free, like, go look at the free agent pool from that summer. It's just like nobody there because everybody was being told, be on your next contract. There's a world where Stern shuts us out for the next year. And it's revisionist history to be like, well, he could have just come here in free agency. We didn't know if there was going to be a free agency the next season. So yeah, that is my Melo talk, my Melo defense for the night.
I was hoping we would get to that, you know, because again, as a person who listens to KFS a lot, I'm familiar with your affinity for Carmelo.
Thank you. And you're welcome. You know, hopefully.
So I appreciate that. So I want to close out on a couple things. Obviously, you know, we kind of talked to or mentioned the Mets a couple times. So I'm just curious on your kind of quick opinion on this. You know, a lot of rumors about Juan Soto. I mean, do you think they get it done?
I don't. I mentioned this during the live stream the other night. The Nationals, this is honestly from people, I've gotten involved with a Mets blog called Just Mets, where we like do playback watch parties for Mets games. And from what they're saying, like the Nationals hate the Mets. Like they would rather trade like the Washington Monument to New York than Juan Soto. And like would try to fleece us for like the Statue of Liberty, the Empire State Building, all of the above. Point being, like the way the Mets get Juan Soto is like Mike Rizzo gets fired and Ted Lerner dies. And that's like the current regime there is not trading Juan Soto to the Mets. The last trade they made was Matt Dendecker for Jerry Blevins in 2015. The trade before that was Ryan Church and Brian Schneider for Lastings Millage in 2008. They just don't trade to the Mets.
Yeah.
So I think there'll be other ways the Mets improve. I think they will improve, but there's just no scenario in my perspective where the Mets are a Juan Soto team.
And yeah, it's interesting. Like you see like the numbers for these proposed deals, like obviously it's a 15-year deal. It's like, that's insane.
Yeah.
And I look, it's like, why would you want to play for the Nationals for another 15 years? I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's just like, it's just direction. Like you look at like the Angels with Ohtani and Trout, you know, it's just kind of like, and why you want to stay there? There's like basically a minor league team without these two guys.
I will say this. You could give me half of that and I'd learn to live wherever I was for 15 years.
Yeah, for sure. Of course.
I mean, I think he's worth it. For whoever gets him. And it's funny, I have some friends that are big Mets fans, but they love their minor league system. They love to track their players. They're big on Francisco Alvarez, and they're big on Brett Beatty and Mauricio and Vientos and Matt Allen. And when this news dropped, I was teasing them with like, so should I order the Uber for Alvarez to DC now? I'll drive all of them personally if you'd like, just to tease them. And they'd push back with like, one guy doesn't win you a title. And I just asked a simple question. What's a more likely scenario? In the 15 years that the Mets have Juan Soto, hypothetically, they win a World Series. Or in however long, as of right now, at most six, unless they extend him, however long they have Francisco Alvarez, they win the World Series. Like, what's the more likely scenario? And it's like, yeah, 15 years of Juan Soto. I would imagine in that span, the Mets win one, especially with an owner as aggressive as Steve Cohen. And that's as far as the whether to do it or not, that should be the answer. Whether they'll be able to, as I said, I don't think a trade will happen. The one I would keep my eye on, I don't think it'll happen this summer or this deadline. But eventually the Angels are going to want to move on from Ohtani. And that's the type of, like, you're getting an all-star pitcher and a cleanup hitter all in one player. So, like, what's to say the Mets can't be the team that trades for Ohtani or gets him in free agency in 2 years? That would be the actual pipe dream if I'm looking to get a realistic guy.
Dream big,
Andrew.
Dream big.
Listen, he is under contract for another year and a half. What's to say that Steve Cohen in his big pockets wouldn't offer him the biggest deal possible to come here, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I want to close on the Jets, you know.
J-E-T-S, okay.
So, you know, me being an Arab man, root for Rob Saleh. You know, he's
Rob Saleh.
Yeah, Dearborn, Michigan guy. And, you know, so not a lot of us in the NFL. So, you know, I always root for any Arab in professional sports. So, what do you think the outlook is for this team? I love the Sauce Gardner pick in the draft. You know,
me too.
I feel like he's going to be special. You know, Zach Wilson, you don't really know what he's going to be year two. So, well, you know, outside of
I was going to say, I found out some news about my quarterback lately that might have improved my opinion on him a little bit. You know,
he's winning on and off the field.
Yes, got that dog in him, Mr. Wilson.
Got that dog in him. Yeah. So, I mean, what do you think we could expect from the Jets this year?
Man, it's funny. Brady Quinn, when I guess whatever outlet he's on, and said that people can talk about the Jets all they want. They're going to start the season 1-9 or 1-8, whatever their first nine games are. They're really tough. And at first I was like, who's Brady Quinn? I don't need to hear anything. I looked at their schedule and I was like, all right, I see it. If you want to say that, I think they made significant improvements. They have young, like the three first round picks. They got an edge rusher, a corner, and a receiver. And then like Breece Hall with your first pick in the second round, like it's a similar Alvin Kamara pick, that is like where you find value when you go get playmakers in the second round. I think there could be a better than expected 9-8 team. I'm also a little skeptical, and this is just my own personal PTSD. I was in on Sam Darnold. I was in on Todd Bowles, believe it or not. I was like, they're 10-5. This is a team that could make the Super Bowl. And then week 17 happens against Rex and the Bills. This, I will say, is one of the more well put together as far as collection of talent, which is where I trust Joe Douglas in like what he did with Philly and how like Nick Foles came in a Super Bowl because you're so deep at every position that like next man up really is a thing there. And look, I like the offense. I like the San Francisco roots that they come with. And I hesitate to give anything more than like they'll win 9 games. Like that is the extent to which I can go. Maybe they can get to 10 and they can be the Bengals of last year. Maybe they're like a 7-10 team, and that is actually a positive step because it's 2 more wins than last year. But yeah, I mean, it all depends on the quarterback. If he's the guy, then he'll start to show it this year too, but we'll see. I'm cautiously optimistic without even a little bit starting to dream about like a playoff berth, let alone like a deep playoff run by this football team.
That's the tempered expectations of the Jets, right?
You know, very much like, so. Very much so. Yeah. Yes.
And you know, the division is super unfortunate. You know, like Tom Brady leaves and, mm-hmm. you know, now Josh Allen is ascending. You know, it's can't win. You know, yeah.
I will say the Bills, other than 2 years ago, like they're not the greatest regular season team, no. you know? So there's a world where like 11-6 wins the division. Again, I think the Dolphins are going to be better, obviously, with Tyreek Hill and a new coach. It still comes down to the quarterback, though. And like one could argue the Jets have the worst quarterback in the division. One could argue that they have the second best quarterback in the division, depending how you feel about New England's guy. I'm, again, cautiously optimistic without even a little bit daring. Like, I want to see the games get played. I've had too many week ones. Was like, you know what? I'm going to enjoy the Jets this year. Oh, they're down 21-0. Here we go again. Okay.
Yeah, it's I feel like those NFL losses just hurt more, you know, because you're like waiting all week for it. Like, yeah, you could see the Knicks get blown out by 25 one night. And, you know, a couple nights later, you mm-hmm. got another chance, you know, like with the Mets the next day, you know, they got another chance. And
baseball is literally short memory of they will literally be here. The sun will come up tomorrow and they'll play another game.
Whereas in football, you're like a week. Yeah,
a whole week. And who knows if that's even a good thing that I get to watch this team again in a week, you know?
Yeah, I mean, just again, living in the Detroit area here, I could speak to the fan bases here.
You get it.
A fan base here that is just starving. And it's funny because, you know, they've made a couple moves and friends were like, oh, you better jump on this bandwagon while you can, you know? And I'm just like, you know, I appreciate the enthusiasm, but I don't know. I don't know about that, about the team over here, but Andrew, man, I really want to thank you for jumping on. I really appreciate it. I usually plug people's where they can find them, but you have so much to plug. So I was going to let you do that. Where can everybody find you?
You can find Nick's Film School. We have a link tree in the Nick's Film School Twitter account or linktree.com/ Nick's Film School. We have a podcast. We have a YouTube channel. We have a Patreon. We have a newsletter. We have a Twitter account, all the things that you want to find content on, you can head over to Nick's Film School and find us there. Wall-to-wall coverage of the New York Mets, Freudian slip, of the New York Knicks throughout the offseason, however long this offseason continues to go. And you can find Final Review on the same places as far as the podcast is concerned, on iTunes or on Spotify. Both pods are part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. So if you wanted to go there and search either in pop culture or basketball, we are found there. And you can find me on Twitter at AndrewJClaudio_, most likely tweeting about the Mets this summer. Omar, this was great, man. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it, Andrew. Really do. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You can catch Worldwide Knicks on your podcast platform of choice, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the like. Catch us on Twitter at WWKnicksPodcast, where we tweet sensationalist things about this basketball team that we love. Andrew, thank you again. appreciate you coming on. And go Mets, go Knicks, go
Yes, let's go Mets, indeed.